Welcome to part three of the April edition of the AA Grapevine, the magazine of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Vicki Duke, and I'm your volunteer broadcaster coming to you from member-supported Sun Sounds of Arizona. We are continuing in the magazine. Now, a story on step four, A Good Cleaning, by Bill Kay of West Bend, Wisconsin. When we get to step four, we're told to do a personal inventory. And to be brutally honest, it's enough to scare anyone. We're supposed to write out our past history of good and bad traits, including all of our lying and cheating and people that we've hurt. We unload our baggage, look at long-held resentments, reveal hidden feelings, and come clean on all the wrongs that we've done. At first glance, this can be extremely intimidating. However, there's a bright side. We get to discover the good things in our lives, too. I recently decided to clean out my kitchen junk drawer. It was overflowing with objects I no longer needed, making it difficult to find things. As I approached this seemingly insurmountable task, the thought that went through my mind was, yuck, where do I start? I took everything out of the drawer. TV wires, eyeglass cases, screwdrivers, screws, nuts, bolts, and more, until the drawer was empty. The items, some good, useful, and some bad, no longer useful, covered my kitchen table. Here's a list of what I found in the drawer. 3 stud finders, 20 screwdrivers, 6 TV-related connectors, candy that was over 3 years old, 1 rubber elf ear, yes, only one, 1 tape measure, 1 flashlight, and hundreds of assorted screws. The personal moral inventory that I took in step 4 contains some of the following qualities: resentments, hate, stealing, hurting loved ones, love for others, being a hard worker, being a good husband and a wonderful grandfather, and being a reliable friend. In both cases, it was pretty obvious that some things could and should be kept, but that others needed to go. That's how we do step 4. Empty the drawer and look at what we have so we can make decisions about what we need to get rid of and what we can't keep. Eliminating the junk from my junk drawer will leave room for the supplies I actually need. The payoff for working these steps is to ensure that there's plenty of room for our higher power, love, honesty, and trust in our lives. Without step 4, none of this is possible. The only question that I was left with after my thorough house cleaning was, what happened to that other elf ear? Next, a story on Tradition 4, The Opportunity to Do Better, by Carrie B. of Bend, Oregon. She loved this Tuesday night meeting because the group let her bring her child. Problem was, it was listed as a closed meeting. When I was new to AA, one of my favorite meetings to attend was a Tuesday night women's meeting. It wasn't my home group, but it was one of my favorite meetings. It was a closed meeting, but they allowed me to bring my 4-year-old daughter with me. They had a group conscience to allow children. I told my sponsor all about this meeting and how much I liked it. When I got 6 months of sobriety, it happened to be on a Tuesday. My sponsor came with me to this women's meeting to give me my 6-month coin. Because it was her first time visiting this meeting, I asked her afterward how she liked it. She said it seemed like a nice meeting, but she looked a bit confused. She asked me if she had heard right when they were reading the script and said that the meeting was closed. I confirmed that yes, that was one of the reasons I felt comfortable in the meeting. Then she asked why I was bringing my daughter to a closed meeting. I explained to her that they allow everyone to bring their kids and that it was a group conscience decision by the members. That's when I first learned a lot more about Tradition 4. My sponsor took the time that evening to explain to me what a closed meeting is for. She explained that even though I don't personally choose to hide my anonymity, there are some members who need their anonymity to be protected. Some professionals can't risk running into their patients or clients, school teachers, pediatricians, and counselors, among others, may actually need that meeting to be closed. And while I'm free to attend any meeting I like, open or closed, some members are only able to attend closed meetings. They depend on being able to look for that word closed in the AA meeting directory, knowing their anonymity will be protected. My sponsor told me I don't have the right to risk someone else's anonymity by bringing my daughter to a closed meeting, no matter what their group conscience says. She explained that in our 12 and 12 book in the chapter about Tradition 4, it states that every group has the right to be wrong. And in this case, she thought the group was wrong. She told me that once I know better, I have the opportunity to do better, just like in any other inventory work. More is always revealed. I stopped attending that meeting on the nights that I had my daughter. Coincidentally, my daughter started school the very next year, and you'll never guess how she knew the in-training principal. Yes. From the closed women's meeting. I felt terrible, but the principal was very gracious and understanding. Since then, I have a much deeper respect for all the traditions. I also have a better understanding of the fourth tradition in that it was never intended to be used to void any of the other traditions. The traditions were meant to work together in unity, not against each other. One tradition doesn't cancel another one out. Each group is autonomous in their own customs and practices, not their own steps and traditions. Does the group want to clap or chant? Should the meeting be an hour or an hour and a half? How much money should the group keep as a prudent reserve? Does the group give out coins at the beginning or the end of the meeting or not at all? Each group should have their own formats and their own customs, but the 12 traditions are the same for every group. And if my home group is breaking a tradition, we are affecting AA as a whole because that's what we're passing on to new people, our future old-timers. The next story, Boys Don't Cry, by Bree H. of Fort Myers, Florida. A trans member in Florida shares her personal journey of alcoholism and getting outside help. Growing up in Midwestern suburbs, I had a narrow view of the world, as everyone around me were normal, middle-class, church-going people. They must have been living by a set of rules that I was unaware of. It became obvious at a young age that I didn't quite fit in anywhere. Although I knew something wasn't right, I couldn't put my finger on exactly what it was. Two things I was keenly aware of were judgment and alcohol. both were abundant at all family gatherings. Being the oldest of four, I was the beer runner for my dad, which allowed me to have my first drink well before turning 10. I didn't get buzzed, but I acquired a taste for more. I was a sensitive child. Once, after a car accident took the life of a family friend, I was sad and crying. My father used the old standard of boys don't cry and threatened to give me something to cry about. I learned quickly that it wasn't safe to be different. I tried hard to behave and act like my male cousins and other boys. No matter how hard I tried, I never measured up. Knowing it wasn't safe to cry, I bottled up those feelings and turned them into anger and rage. As a high school freshman, I worked backstage for our annual school play. Unexpectedly, after a performance, I was invited to go riding around with some of the cool kids from the senior class. We were cruising around, drinking, and making out. I didn't know their motivation, and I didn't care. I was only aware that alcohol was involved, and I felt like I finally fit in somewhere. Alcohol seemed to be the elixir that made me hip, slick, and cool. As you might expect, those people had nothing to do with me afterward. I chased the high of that night for 17 years, trying to repeat the magical feelings. Instead, I just kept getting drunk, blacking out, and ending up in bad places. As a teenager and young man, I persistently felt the need to demonstrate my masculinity. I attended a military junior college, excelling in academics, Army ROTC, and in partying hard. Always striving to fit in, I became a redneck, homophobic, drunken horse's rear end. I somehow eked out an engineering degree while drinking alcoholically, sometimes taking exams with a massive hangover. One of these drunken episodes included threatening a man leaving a gay bar for absolutely no reason. Perpetuating the masculine ruse, I fulfilled an obligation to the Army, got married, and fathered a child. It was clear that alcohol was more important to me than a military career. I went to work as a civil servant for the Navy and found fellow vets to drink and party with. I frequently put myself at risk while driving drunk, occasionally doing so with my young daughter in the car. Thankfully, she wasn't with me when I wrecked my truck and got a DUI. It's only by God's grace that I survived, but even that didn't put a stop to my drinking. I finally hit bottom during my first divorce and found my way into the rooms of AA in December of 1988. Life started getting better, but there was still something wrong. Not understanding the root cause of my feelings, I thought another marriage was the answer. At some level of consciousness, I knew marriage was perpetuating the ruse. Of course, I made this decision solely on my own, no discussion with my sponsor. From the outside, we seemingly had a great family life, but on the inside, despite being 7 years sober, I was miserable, angry, and suicidal. With help from my sponsor, I finally sought help with a mental health professional. Early in the process, the therapist asked what I was most afraid of discovering. I quickly answered that I was scared to find out I was gay. After a few more sessions, I was in for an even bigger shock. I wasn't gay. I was diagnosed with gender identity disorder. The common word today is transgender. This discovery was shocking. However, it was also comforting to finally know what the it was that I had been feeling my entire life. Using the tools bestowed upon me in sobriety, I survived a slow journey of exploration and transition that included a second divorce, a legal name change, and a successful transition at work. Following protocols, 1 year later, I had gender-confirming surgery and finalized all the legal changes to be recognized as a female. At no point along this journey did I find it necessary to take a drink. The quality of my sobriety and my life got immensely better. I was significantly less angry and experienced periods of serenity. Through my job, I was able to complete a master's degree program and then was selected for a developmental job opportunity that required relocation. There, I found a new home group at a women's meeting, got a new sponsor, and for the first time in my life, developed true friendships. These women accepted and loved me for who I was and did not even care about my past. I finally fit in, but it was a struggle for me to recognize that. My life changed so much. My daughter has a son that has only ever known me as Grandma Bree. I strive to be the best grandmother I can be. Fundamental throughout my sobriety has been service work. I served as a GSR and as a DCM, and I fell in love with the traditions. I often share that the traditions are so important to me because I want AA to be available in case my grandson needs it one day. Along this journey, I learned firsthand that sexual orientation and gender identity were completely separate issues. At various times, I have identified as a straight man, a gay man, a lesbian, and now as a bisexual woman. I had to learn that the gender of a person I'm with does not define what my gender is. Despite all I have been through, including another failed marriage, this time to a man, I'm still working to really love and accept myself without judgment. Thank goodness for the phrase, progress, not perfection. More often than not, I have a sense of peace and serenity in my life as a direct result of working the steps with a sponsor, being of service, and having a relationship with my higher power. But some days it's still easier to be kind to others than it is to myself. I have a great retirement life in Florida. I may be living alone, but I'm not alone. I have a home group, a sponsor, sponsees, and group service positions. I have the love and support of my family. I will always be dad to my daughter, but that doesn't impact the phenomenal relationship we have. After transitioning to become my true self, a sober woman, I'm a much better parent to my daughter. This former drunken redneck is so blessed to be grandma to a rambunctious 14-year-old boy. There was a time I didn't want to live this long, but now I get immense joy from being a father, grandmother, daughter, and sister. None of these things were possible without AA. Next story, One Seder at a Time, by Definitely Steve of Nashville, Tennessee. A newcomer navigates his first real social test. Thank goodness for helpful old-timers and grape juice. My marriage was falling apart. My kids were totally confused, hurt, and suffering. My finances were a shambles. I was broke, heavily in debt, but still living a luxurious lifestyle. I had high blood pressure, anxiety, and panic attacks. I sweated profusely, and insomnia ruined every day of my life. But I kept saying I was doing just fine. So why then, if I thought everything wasn't so bad, would I see a therapist? I'll tell you why. When thoughts of suicide or skipping town became two reasonable solutions to my problems, it dawned on me that I better talk to someone about it. The therapist insisted at my first visit that I go to AA before he would see me again. What's wrong with this guy? Doesn't he know who he's talking to? Truth was, I had no place else to go. I had tried everything to get my life back on track. Nothing seemed to work. So 2 days later, on a Monday night in 1989, I walked, or staggered, into my very first AA meeting on Long Island, New York. Right away, I thought I really didn't belong there. I wasn't as bad as all those people. It was humiliating. What if neighbors saw me there? It was perfectly okay to be seen drunk and urinating on my front lawn at 3 in the morning, but it was catastrophic to be seen walking into an AA meeting. Little did I know that I had not only taken my last drink, but I was about to be starting an incredible new God-centered life. What was the first major test of my new sober lifestyle? It wasn't dinner without a great bottle of red or white, or better yet, a bottle of both. It wasn't attending a Mets game without beer. It wasn't even relaxing after a tough day at the office with several whiskeys on the rocks. Not that either. The first major test occurred when I realized I couldn't celebrate the Jewish holiday of Passover with the traditional glasses of wine. The highlight of Passover is the Seder, the 2-hour marathon religious dinner where sips of wine accompany every prayer. And boy, we seem to be praying for everything. The truth was that I had never taken a sip of wine in my entire life. Furthermore, I don't think I ever attended a sober Seder either. How on earth could I do this? But my new friends in AA knew exactly what to do. I was amazed that they had gone through similar situations in early sobriety themselves, and they didn't tell me what to do. They just told me what worked for them and what didn't. The old-timers at my meeting mapped out a plan for this know-it-all AA newcomer. Number one, tell the host beforehand that because of my health, I can't have any wine. Could I have grape juice instead? Two, bring along AA phone numbers and use them if I feel like drinking. Three, drive my own car just in case I have to make a quick getaway. Four, arrive late and leave early. Five, if possible, find a seat where I don't even see the bottles of wine. Six, immediately fill my glass with grape juice so no one will fill it with wine. And seven, go to an AA meeting before and after the Seder. Share with members what I'm doing. I really didn't enjoy my first sober Seder. I was just so preoccupied with my own wine issues, but the boys assured me that future sober Seders would get much easier. One Seder at a time. They were so right. Do I miss the good old days? No, I don't miss the absolute need to arrive at the Seder with a buzz. I don't miss the conniving it took to find the seat closest to the wine. I don't miss showing off. I was always on stage telling everyone how successful I was. Even when I was totally broke, I looked really great, even though I definitely didn't feel that way. I don't miss the job of making sure everyone's having a great time. I don't miss the drive home. Only an alcoholic could rationalize during driving his wife and kids home after 2 hours of red wine. And I certainly don't miss the hangovers, the headaches, and all the apologies. And now, 32 years later, what a difference. It's all about being with my family now. I'm eternally grateful and blessed that they never gave up on me. Well, this is the end of part 3 and the end of the April edition of the AA Grapevine. Again, my name is Vicki Duke, and I am coming to you from member-supported Sun Sounds of Arizona.